Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Lowy Institute. For those of you who were here yesterday, I see some familiar faces in the audience, so it's wonderful that you've been able to come out 2 days in a row. Welcome to the Lowy Institute and to our latest event, which is a little bit different from yesterday's, and eerily well-timed, according to the news from the United Kingdom overnight. I woke to the dulcet tones of Boris Johnson on my transistor radio this morning, and yes, they do still exist. For the first time in 1,000 years, he says, this place, this parliament will not have a say over the laws that govern this country. It is a quite incredible state of affairs. Downing Street has confirmed a draft agreement had been reached in Brussels last night and that the cabinet would meet at 2 o'clock on Wednesday to discuss it. I am Alex Oliver. I'm the director of research for the Lowy Institute. And with me, I have a panel of real experts on this issue, and that is not an easy thing to find. Firstly, on my left, Tikki Fullerton is one of Australia's most respected business journalists. She was a long-time presenter on ABC's Late Line Business, the anchor of the ABC's The Business, and now has a business program named after her called Tikki, which was until recently on Sky News Business, but which has now become a cable and free TV channel, Your Money. Before her media career, she was an investment banker and associate director with Credit Suisse, first Boston in London and then in Sydney, raising capital for business and government. She obtained a law degree at Magdalen College at Oxford University, where she was a contemporary of, you guessed it, Boris Johnson. Amory Elijah is on Tikki's left, and she is Associate Director at the ANU Centre for European Studies and an authority on Britain and the EU, having completed her PhD on this very topic, of Britain's bid for the EU membership back some 3 decades ago. She's held policy roles at the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and her current research, including a recent edited book, focuses on Australia-EU relations, economic integration, regionalism and trade policy. And then finally, and not least, Hervé Lemahieu is my colleague and director of the Lowy Institute's Asian Power and Diplomacy Program. Hervé joined the Lowy Institute from London's leading think tank, oh, I shouldn't tell Chatham House that, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS, from which we poached him to become the architect and research lead on our recently released Asia Power Index, which is a very detailed and data-based analysis of the indices of power and power balances among 25 Asian nations, including the United States, China and Russia, but not, at this stage, the EU. Hervé has a Master of Science in Global Governance and Diplomacy from the University of Oxford. He's also a Belgian national, and so matters in Brussels are very close to his heart. So, with our expert panel, we are going to discuss and try and dissect this very thorny issue. With the May government and the EU having agreed to that final text of the Brexit deal overnight, apparently there are more than 400 pages of intricate detail that sets up the possibility of a special European Council meeting on November the 25th to ratify those terms, but we've got a long way to go before then, Hervé. So perhaps you'd like to do a little scene setter for us.
Absolutely. So I think what happened overnight was very significant. A real breakthrough for Theresa May after over a year of really heavy discussions and negotiations where at different points it looked as if these things wouldn't resolve themselves. We now have a document of between 400 and 500 pages, which needs to be digested by not only Theresa May, but her cabinet and then eventually Parliament. But we don't know the details of that. That will be forthcoming within the next few days and weeks. It's being tightly guarded. It's what's known as in the tunnel. So the information there is being kept under wraps. And Theresa May is now dealing with a number of her ministers in cabinet, and then will convene the cabinet as a whole. But what she's presenting to her cabinet now is essentially, let's be frank, two unpalatable options. I mean, one is her deal, and the other one is no deal. For her deal, essentially you have the UK that is bound up with the European Union for an undetermined period of time within what's known as a customs partnership. For no deal, you would essentially have Britain or the UK leave on the 29th of March next year in a state of chaos that will cause inevitable disruption And Theresa May is hoping that the fear of that disruption will persuade her colleagues to go for her deal. But how we came to this, I mean, and this is all about the withdrawal agreement, it's not even about the future state of the relationship between the EU and Britain, it really is down to a few sticking points. And the border with Northern Ireland, so the border between the Republic and Northern Ireland, was the key sticking point for Theresa May and for Brussels. It became clear at some point between December last year, when essentially Brussels and London agreed to a sort of fudged commitment that they wouldn't have a hard border between or within Ireland, that the EU was going to dictate the terms and had the essentially the strength in terms of the power balance between EU and London. And that it was seeking that Northern Ireland remain as part of the regulatory single market of the European Union in order to guarantee that there was no hard border. Theresa May, realizing that she was in a bit of a hole and that she couldn't really fudge this anymore, decided, I mean, she had two choices. One was to, at that point, say, okay, we're going for no deal. Or was to kind of accept that she needed to dig the hole deeper and wider by putting the entire United Kingdom in that so-called backstop. So it wasn't just a Northern Irish question, but would also count for all of the UK so that she wouldn't risk sidelining her colleagues in government, the DUP, who were very clear that there should be no sort of border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. So what Theresa May has now done is essentially said the UK will remain for an undetermined period of time associated with the customs union and of the continent, and that is very upsetting to a number of Brexiteers. So that's in as short a summarization as I could possibly manage what has unfolded over the last course of 18 months and then overnight.
Nice job. reaction overnight.
Not asking me to do that.
Jacob Rees-Mogg, Nigel Dodds, the DUP guy, they've all reacted overnight. What has been the reaction? And are there any prospects at all that Theresa May can pull this off?
Well, I think there's quite a good prospect that she'll pull something off some way. It's a very, very interesting time to have this discussion right now. The latest thing that I have seen from Britain was a tweet from Tom Newton Dunn, who's political editor of The Sun. It's pretty well sourced. And he says, Brexit deal latest, cabinet sources say May's pivotal five senior ministers, these are the people that she actually has to have on board. Otherwise, if they resign, they might stand against her, apart from anything else, the Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, the Home Secretary Sajid Javid, and the Environment Secretary Michael Gove and Cox. They will all back it. Ledsam and Grayling are also on board, McVeigh and Morden so far not. Now, if true, this is a massive internal victory for both her and indeed for Ollie Robbins, who is the European negotiator that has been conjuring up checkers and pushing it through Brussels. So that would be, as I say, a situation where, you know, Hervé, he's talking about the Brexiteers being angry. If you just look at the Johnson brothers, for example, Boris Johnson, he's obviously the Brexiteer. Joe Johnson is a Remainer. Now, he has stepped down because he is furious about this leaving us in the customs union and also being very unclear about whether Britain does become this vassal state and whether Britain does lose its powers even beyond the end of 2020.
Anne-Marie, what have you got to say about how this is playing out, perhaps from both sides of the fence, the Brussels side and the London side?
Okay, so I agree with you. This, what's happened overnight is incredibly significant. It's a great time to have this conversation, but I'm not so sure about what's going to happen next. I mean, I think the only thing we've been able to conclude in recent months, perhaps over the past couple of years, is that British politics is now so uncertain that trying to predict what's going to happen next has become really hazardous. Having said that, I think we're now entering a period where we're so close to the potential for a no-deal Brexit that we're looking at a series of kind of potential political breakpoints. So one is obviously the cabinet process, the emergency cabinet meeting, which is about to happen. Then we're looking at a British parliamentary process. A great deal can happen in that context as well. But of course, the colour and movement on the British side of this negotiation has been so significant that everyone has largely forgotten about the EU27, which is the other key part of this equation. So we now have a process going on inside the European Union as well. Those of you who know the EU will know that it's an incredibly complex set of institutions. Just thinking about that, we need to know there are uncertainties there too. What we probably can say is that we're moving towards an EU summit on the 25th of November, but that presupposes that this gets some sort of cabinet approval in the UK. At that point then, the EU27 will all have an opportunity to scrutinise the proposed deal. And under the terms of Article 50, it's not the case that all member states need to be on board, but 20 of the 27 need to be on board and a majority of the EU population overall. So they're the kind of parameters of the qualified majority voting system, which is set out in Article 50. And Article 50 is very, very scant. It doesn't tell us much, but it does tell us that what will happen is there'll be a qualified majority vote in the European Union and then European parliamentary approval. Now, none of that is a given. All sorts of things can happen in the course of that process. So just to sort of remind everyone, what's going on the other side of the channel is, of course, very important here. And maybe we'll see issues arise in the coming weeks that haven't had much attention up until this point, mainly because the negotiations have been going on inside the UK itself instead of with the EU27, which is where the focus should have been.
What are some of the other issues that could come up? Hervé's just briefly touched on the hard issue of the hard border in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. What else? You talk about a number of other things that might come up.
So look, two big ones from the British end. And one is the notion of if Theresa May's Chequers is endorsed by Cabinet, what happens during the transition period? And what happens when we get to the backstop? If there is disagreement between Britain and Europe, what does it say in those 500 pages about whether Britain can unilaterally decide to get out, or who in Europe has got to agree to that as well? Secondly, if they can't agree, will the European Court of Justice have a role in arbitrating that or not? Because that's one of the reasons why the Brexiteers wanted to get out in the first place. Secondly, which is the very important issue, and it's a bit like Rumsfeld's known unknowns. I mean, we just don't know where we're going here, but we know we've got these unknowns, and that is the actual Irish border. Now, as I understand this at the moment, Robert Peston has got a really good piece in The Spectator in the last 24 hours. There is some suggestion that this fudge is that within Northern Ireland going forward, that Northern Ireland will, you'll be out of the customs union, but Northern Ireland will still have sort of customs union plus sort of slightly more than that in terms of the way it trades. So it will be slightly different and slightly closer to Europe than Britain. So if that's the case, to what extent does that start putting a line down through the Irish Sea? And if there's any chance that that happens, then that could cause, I mean, is there an opportunity for potentially going forward Europe to meddle in British-Irish affairs? Mm. And then that starts being really messy. And we haven't talked about the parliamentary vote, which is, I mean, when Lord Hague was out here the other day, he said he gave it 50% of getting the deal done and through the British Parliament. And you've got this really interesting mix of, say, the Joe Johnsons, the remaining anti-Chequers, plus you've got the ERG, the Brexiteers, plus you've got the DUP. Now, if enough of them get together, then it won't get through Parliament. But on the other hand, a lot of those Remainers won't want to knock off Theresa May because they'll get a Brexiteer in probably to replace her. Mm.
Anne-Marie, so what happens if that UK parliamentary vote does go awry? What happens then?
So there are a number of scenarios. As with all of these potential political breakpoints, I think there are a number of scenarios. One is that May immediately loses the leadership. Another one is that we immediately move to another general election. There's also the possibility of going back to the EU27 and saying, look, we need to negotiate further and we need more time. Now, under Article 50, if all EU27 agree, the period of time can be lengthened. So, in fact, the EU27 could grant more time for a negotiating period, but all of them have to agree. Now, there's no special reason why all 27 would necessarily want to prolong this business, so you know, that's a live question. So, really, we're looking at you know a number of possibilities there, and that could all happen before Christmas.
Hervé, we've talked about this and the EU being sort of unexpectedly firm on this and a great negotiator. What are the prospects for the 27 to actually smooth out this process?
I think in the beginning we often assumed that Britain would present a very united front in the negotiations and that the potential for internal divisions and squabbling lay almost exclusively on the European side, on the continental side, because you were dealing with 27 member states. But Michel Barnier has done a very good job and was empowered with a strong mandate to forge a united line, and they've kept their word. They've remained very cohesive. As we move into negotiations about the future trade relationship with the UK, you might see more divisions between member states that are more exposed in terms of their trade portfolio with the UK and those that are less exposed, and along ideological lines as well. Macron and Merkel, who are both sort of embattled at home, really need to prove a point here, which is that the European project is more than just economics, and they're willing to incur economic costs for the sake of proving a political point, which is the sanctity of the single market and the four freedoms, the freedom of movement of people in particular. So I think those sorts of issues may actually start rearing their heads more in the coming months and years, and that you might potentially find a more divided EU. The other point about the EU, I think, is that they, you know, we sort of think that, well, Theresa May has had to concede pretty much all along to the Brussels line, and that's true. There's been a power imbalance between the EU and Britain all along, but they do appear to have conceded a pretty significant point, which was that Theresa May said, no, there can be no Northern Ireland or Northern Irish backstop. It has to be a UK-wide backstop. For a lot of European member states, there is a concern, therefore, that actually that backstop is a sort of de facto free trade agreement with the UK before we've even gotten to that point in the negotiations. So whereas it's viewed with a lot of skepticism in Britain, it's also viewed with a degree of skepticism in Europe. Now, coming back to the British question, it's true, I'm absolutely in agreement with Tiki there. There seems to be a sort of a perfect storm or an alignment all of a sudden between the hardcore Brexiteers, Boris, and the Remainers, Joe, the Johnson brothers, in that both are agreed that Theresa May's plan is highly flawed and it presents a really bad alternative for the UK. They're disagreed about the future, but they are agreed on the point that Theresa May isn't providing the answers there. And that's very curious, and it does look as if Theresa May's numbers in both in her cabinet and in Parliament are very precarious. But I will say Theresa May, to her credit, has proven to be an enormous political survivor. I mean, she got out of a general election. Yeah, absolutely. And has, at every twist and turn, despite the chronic weakness, or perhaps in spite of her weakness, because no one has dared to rock the boat, because the consequences of that within the Tory party would have been severe, yeah. She has proven to be the survivor. And she may now well play the scare tactic card very well, in the sense that neither the Remainers nor the Leavers would be happy with her plan, but they accept that the alternative, which is the precipice of the no-deal scenario, is so bad, has so much uncertainty, would incur so much disruption, that you have to stick with her plan.
But if you believe the conspiracy theories, you'd say, and again, it's sort of an Ollie Robbins-driven thing, which is, I mean, he was back in Oxford doing European studies right from the get-go, so he's a great Europhile. And he, if they were going to negotiate this in a tough way, let's forget all the division within the British Parliament, they would have actually put some money down on no deal, hard Brexit. You know, they would have spent some money to show, yeah, we're prepared to go that way. that they did not do that. And I think we're now in a situation where it is actually very difficult for them to threaten a no deal, and Britain isn't ready for that sort of just-in-time manufacturing interruption. It didn't have to be like this. But if you think of the red lines or the lines in the sand, I mean, we're nearly there. We're nearly at Liam Fox's line in the sand now. It'll be interesting to see where he goes. But the red lines that she's crossed in terms of what she promised, the election, the Lancaster speech, it is quite possible that Britain will remain in the customs union after the backstop. Now, if that happens and we lose any input into future legislation and directives within Europe, then I think the people who criticise the Chequers deal have every right to say, well, this is actually a worse situation than we were in before we even had the referendum.
Talking about worst situations then, Anne-Marie, what is the worst case scenario? There have been a number of them. What happens in the worst case scenario?
Okay, so I think most people have come to assume that the no deal situation is the worst case scenario, just because there are so many unknowns, because a number of people are predicting kind of chaos across a number of sectors. So in many ways, I mean, we need to just remember for a moment and go back to that point in the referendum campaign when it kind of became clear that the people who wanted to leave didn't have a plan. And I think a lot of the trouble we're in now stems from this problem. So you'll recall that at the time the British government did quite a lot of work on what it would look like to remain a member of the European Union. Very little work was done or any kind of consensus building around what it would look like if the Brits were to leave.
And well, I think that was because every bureaucrat in Britain had spent time in Brussels and didn't want to leave, so nobody wanted to work on the other plan. I mean, wouldn't you?
There's an element of truth there. Yes, absolutely, Tiki, I agree. But, you know, that's the truth. Like, there was no plan. Mm. And then most of the architects of Vote Leave promptly vanished, leaving other people to, in fact, implement this situation. So now we've had to sort of work through, or the British have had to work through a series of scenarios which were not planned for, which are kind of highly unpredictable, and now that's kind of where we're headed. So it will be very interesting now to see whether what we're looking at with Theresa May's government is a kind of, you know, a textbook case of political brinkmanship, which ultimately kind of pays off and she somehow gets through this, or whether we're looking at the kind of end of a long-running thing which has had to reach a tipping point and which we're nearly there, in which there's some other kind of cataclysmic development. So that's, I think, where we're up to, and that's why the next few weeks is so very interesting. In terms of kind of worst-case scenarios, I'm not sure. There's a lot of talk about, for example, the possibility of another general election, another referendum. People are talking about a second referendum, but we all need to remember as well this is the third referendum. We've had a first referendum already in 1975, and the Brits actually voted to stay in. And then we had another one in 2016 where they voted to leave. And now there's talk about whether or not it's legitimate to have yet another vote at this point after the country's had kind of a couple of years of wrangling about, you know, whether or not the UK wants to be in. I mean, the only thing I can say in favour of the current period of political uncertainty is at least Brits are much more informed about what the EU is. I think the average person probably also knows what a customs union is. Now, we weren't there a couple of years ago, were we? So that's an interesting set of developments. Maybe voters are now better placed to vote and to choose. But if I can make it a peculiarly Australian observation, one of the things that would have helped this situation is if that referendum had actually entailed a compulsory vote. And of course it didn't. So, you know, what we've got is a 52-48 split on a turnout of 70-odd%, which is pretty high for a British
referendum. It's the highest vote ever in Britain, wasn't it?
It was very high, up there with general election votes, which is very good. But on the other hand, it's still only 70-odd% of your population. If you forced everybody to vote on that question, then whatever the outcome is, everybody has to live with it.
And a very low turnout of the Gen Ys who couldn't be bothered going to vote in the rain, but then were really unhappy with the result. Tiki, just quickly before we go to question and answer, I wanted to talk about the idea of global Britain and the idea of Britain being the Singapore of Europe. So if Brexit succeeds in its most highly evolved form, What is the outcome for Britain? Is it possible that Britain can actually pull this off economically so that it's not just a sort of a political gesture but becomes an economic success?
Look, I'm very glass half full on Britain's ability to go out and do trade deals were it given that freedom. Mm. And I think, you know, when people say, oh, well, how could you possibly do a deal with Donald Trump or, you know, one down here or anywhere, and what would it matter anyway? I think you'd be surprised how markets work given the freedom. How much of an impact that will have, I mean, you look at, as you say, Singapore, there are lots of reasons why Singapore has been so brilliant at what it's done. And, you know, Britain is now living in a rather different era than it was in 1973.
Slightly geographically differently located as well.
Yeah, but that said, I do think, you see, we've hardly talked about trade here. Mm. This entire conversation has been about politics, really, geopolitics. And there are other reasons why Britain will be just fine, thank you very much. And it will be about the relationships, including the relationships between Britain and Europe. I mean, I thought it was stark when all that poisoning stuff happened in Britain with the Russians, how quickly, even though we were sort of daggers drawn, you know, with Farage and Juncker and, you know, Barnier, how quickly Europe ran to Britain's aid and spoke out as Europe supporting Britain in this case against Russia. So I think the relationships will be just fine. Britain's place in the world will be just fine. And Europe needs Britain, you know, from a security point of view, from a financial services point of view. I think Britain will remain very strong.
So there's not going to be an evacuation of all of the financial services headquarters, you know, out of London and into...
Once again, I think this is a little bit like Y2K. You've got to sort of go back to the start. And when this referendum happened, it is staggering to me that the referendum came through with Brexit. Because just think about it. You've got the whole of academia against it. You've got almost every, as I say, bureaucrat against it. You've got... gosh, the Bank of England governor pretty much against it. You've got probably the church as well, although not God, according to Brexiteers.
But an excellent retail politician in the form of one Boris Johnson.
Totally. But I think, you know, to think that you could then proceed and get through this without problems, you've also got all of big business you know, largely against it. And they've come out now. I mean, we've just had Ralph Speight down here from JLR. Now, he has come out and talking about just-in-time car manufacturing, and they will be hurt. And obviously, he's hurting in lots of different directions. Now, the last thing he needs on his mind is Brexit. Actually, the European regulations around diesel are far more an issue for him than Brexit. Let's not forget that from a business point of view, there's one thing that Britain, that business is preparing for to leave Britain whole hog if it happens. And it's not Brexit. It's Jeremy Corbyn and renationalisation. And you ask any major British private businessman who's got big business in Britain, and they will say that a Corbyn Labour government, which has nationalisation high on the agenda, is far more dangerous than a Brexit.
And so the result of a general election, should we get to that point, any predictions on that? That's a big question.
Well, I mean, in a way, it may not matter because Corbyn has agreed to accept the referendum results. So what's interesting is that both parties have agreed to keep a lid on the idea of reopening another referendum because it would be just so painful. But there is a lot of grassroots pressure to have a people's vote and within Labour. And in fact, the shadow Brexit secretary has called for just such a vote in the Labour Party. But you know, there's no question the Labour Party itself faces these internal tensions, the same ones that the Tories are now facing. So it's not clear to me that regardless of the outcome of the general election, the British political system would really be able to come up with a more decisive alternative to what's already taken place. And even if you reopen a referendum and marginally vote in favour of rejoining or remaining within the European Union, you would still have a very highly polarised, highly divided society. So it will take decades to process these kinds of political divisions, and I'm unfortunately I have to disagree with Dickie. I see it as a glass half empty. It's Britain has got itself stuck in a really tough pickle here, and it's very hard to see how it undoes that. I think the other thing is it's been a very costly way of realizing that Britain is now a far diminished player in the world than it used to be. And I'm sure Tiki will disagree with that, but
so much of
what the Brexit, I think, delusion was in the first place was, once unshackled by EU constraints, we can regain our position on in the world, our rightful position. And in a way, that's exactly what's happened. But the rightful position of a Britain severed from the European Union is a far diminished position, in which suddenly the power balance between London and Brussels is staggering, where you do have to accept the Brussels line. And when the day comes that you start negotiating free trade agreements with the US or China, you'll find that you are also the smaller player and have to accept more. Just look at the way that Trump has done free trade negotiations with Canada and Justin Trudeau. They've had to swallow some pretty difficult pills there as well. So the point being, I think it's a very costly way for Britain to come to terms with its position in the world, and also to realize that perhaps it had more influence within the European Union than it does now under Theresa May plan of rule-taking but not rule-making, which is the worst of both worlds.
Well, there we end with... sorry, Emery.
Perhaps the Brits should have asked Australia about what it's like to be outside of the EU many, many years ago, and we can take some historical lessons here. I mean, as a kind of third country dealing with the EU... I agree with you in part, but not altogether in substance. Brussels is the more powerful player here, but that is because the Brits are going to be on the out. And it's very difficult negotiating with a bloc in which, as Juncker famously put it, in is in and out is out. And once the Brits are out, they will be on the receiving end of all sorts of policy making that they won't have any control over. And third countries have known that now for many, many decades. And the EU prioritises, of course, the EU member states. That's what determines EU policy making. And so to be a third country and engage with the EU requires understanding of that. Now, whether the Brits only are processing this sort of belatedly is, I think, an interesting question. But you cannot set the policy parameters of the EU unless you are one of the member states, and those policy parameters will be set in the interests of the EU27 according to a very complex set of internal institutions and policy-making procedures, which I won't go into, but that process is in and of itself a kind of exclusive one to which third countries have great difficulty impacting upon.
Don't forget, there's one tiny little thing I forgot to mention, which is one of the main reasons that people said to have voted for Brexit, which Theresa May will actually, hopefully, from her point of view, be able to hold up as an achievement, which is control of their borders, right? Now, in terms of people flow. Now, I don't even know whether this is true, if this is what she's managed to negotiate, because I don't think the backstop has finally got in there that Britain will have control over its borders. But presumably she'll be able to retrieve that. If she does, that is going to be, going forward, a massive positive for Britain politically, because Europe has a very big problem on its borders, right? As we all know. So that will be a very, very important victory for Theresa May.
And it will play well in the UK.
Very well, yeah. I would have thought.
Well, it's a good point to end on. We've got cup half empty, cup half full, and somewhere in the middle. we now have about 20 to 25 minutes to take some questions from you. So if you could identify yourself and keep your questions to a question and not a comment. I'll start with Bonnie Blay, just up back there.
tend to be post-Brexit future to a deal ever materialise. Potentially, its influence on the multilateral stage has diminished. For example, I'm thinking about the ICJ. So the UK lost a seat for one of its judges on the ICJ just last year, and that should have been quite an easy victory for the UK with some good diplomacy. I'm thinking also about the UN Security Council. So, for example, France will be left alone to represent the whole of the Europe, the European Union, on the international stage and to the UN once Brexit materializes. So I'd like to know, you know, what role will Britain have in the future on the multilateral stage? Thank you.
So potentially it could be enhanced. I think it's a really good question. One question I think many Australians have, for example, is, well, what's the UK going to do in the context of the World Trade Organization? Now, that could be really interesting if the UK was to return to a forum like that and use that multilateral organization in the way that it could be used. But we are yet to see evidence that the UK is capable of tackling it in that way at the moment. So we know, too, that this is a big shift for British foreign and trade policy. They've had to hire a huge bundle of trade negotiators because they didn't have as many as they need. There's going to be a period in which Britain has to find its feet again in those kinds of organisations, and we have to just watch this space. Having said that, I have every confidence that this is exactly what will happen. So I think that some of these developments could be extremely interesting as the UK tries to find alternative ways of having influence globally. But we still expect them to be very strong presence in European forums as well. So
I think when it comes to things like the UN, I come back to security in Europe, particularly with Russia as a rising threat. I think this the whole of Europe will be very interested in keeping Britain, as will Trump, actually, a major player in all the sort of theatres, whether it's Five Eyes or UN or all these are very important. Britain has a very big, it contributes for a start, which Donald Trump likes, but it also is a very big player in the defence industry, and I think will remain so.
Just briefly, I mean, again, coming back to the point I think Tiki made earlier, which is that there's been a remarkable alignment geostrategically and in security terms and in military cooperation between Britain and the leading military powers on the continents, France and Germany and Spain. And I don't think that's going to go away. In fact, I think Theresa May has also tried to make a point of showing that, we can be part of Europe, but not in Europe. The choice really at the UN is, it'll have some reverberations as well. I mean, the UK keeps its Security Council seat, and that's outstanding, so it's not going to be reduced to a minor power anytime soon. France will be under more pressure now, I think, from the rest of the EU to in some way subsume its UN diplomacy under an EU framework, because it's now the sole, as Bonnie was saying, the sole representative of the EU at the Security Council. Germany, which is by far, I think, the biggest European aid donor at the UN, will want more as well. I think they're sort of used to taking the lead from or to devolving their foreign policy at the UN to Britain and France. That's historically been the arrangement, but I think now you're going to see a more proactive Germany on the world stage. The question for Britain is really, two things. One is, do you shore up the Anglosphere? Do you go for a US-UK sort of alignment on things, or USUC, as it's sometimes called?
don't forget India. We always have India.
And India, that's right. But we have to remember also that, there are sort of sentimental, cultural, and historical bounds that bind the Anglosphere together. They're not always of strategic relevance. I mean, Australia has a soft spot for the Republic of Ireland as well. It doesn't mean that there's a huge alliance there either. Or does the UK become a bit more of a Norway, which is in Norway is also not an EU member state, but it does play a very proactive behind-the-scenes role in international diplomacy. So there I would end on a slightly more optimistic note. I think Britain can actually be more inventive and creative with its diplomacy now that it's slightly off on charting its own course.
There was a question just here.
My name's Andrew Proctor. I'm interested in this, the question of a possible second referendum, which was in the news again this morning. The first one was pretty straightforward, stay or leave. This one, presumably, is do we accept what Theresa May's put up? But what does a no vote mean? Does it mean that we don't proceed or we negotiate a bit further? I mean, I can understand the idea of a second referendum, but I don't understand what the no vote would mean or what would it is proposed it would mean.
Isn't it an absolute recipe for disaster for precisely that reason?
Well, the question would be, what would the referendum
put? Nicola Sturgeon will be rubbing her hands with glee, saying, you know, right, well, let's have them all over again, all around. Let's have one for Scotland as well. I think that you've nailed it. What is the question?
Yeah. Basically, four possibilities if there's a no deal now. And either that no deal emerges from the cabinet having no confidence in Theresa May's plan, and that would result in, I think, the end of the premiership for Theresa May, or it's a no vote in Parliament. So what then becomes the question under that scenario, and we'll know pretty soon. But one is Parliament and or government could go back to the negotiating table if they felt that somehow they could extract concessions from Brussels that Theresa May has not been able to do. That would involve working with the Europeans probably to extend the deadline from the 29th of March to some further point, and so it would require some consent, but Brussels would probably play ball because it's still negotiating. The other one would be truly a no deal, and you sever all your contacts or the hope of leaving the European Union with a mutually agreed upon deal, and that doesn't require playing ball with Brussels anymore. You just sort of literally jump on the cliff edge and hope you survive on the 29th of March. The third option would be you go to a general election, and or you go for another people's vote, another referendum. And that is, there's increasing pressure for that, but I'm not sure that, again, that would resolve these outstanding questions. And again, it would require Brussels to play ball with you and your plans, because that would almost necessitate a revision or postponing the Article 50 deadline of the 29th of March. So you need to build more time within the British to allow the British political system to resolve these outstanding questions of appointing a new government or holding a new referendum.
People don't often talk about the ramifications of delaying Article 50 till kicking it down the road if we don't run out of asphalt on all this. One of them is we've got European Parliament elections, right? Now, if you have Article 50 kicked down to after that, you could have Nigel Farage back as an MEP in the European Parliament. Now, that's quite something. The anger in Britain could deliver not necessarily something that Michel Barnier would particularly care for, I would have thought.
Kicking the can down the road?
Yes, well, the EU are past masters at kicking the can down the road. So in some ways, that's what I'm anticipating on a number of fronts. I think this question's a great one because it just reminds us of, again, this, you know, what got us into this mess in the first place. A country with such a strong tradition of parliamentary sovereignty should never have gone to a referendum on a question like this. Parliament is elected for a reason. They should have made a decision. That's what parliaments are for. And unfortunately, once they did that, I think of it as dislocating their own sovereignty. And they're still trying to battle with what has happened since. Now, one thing that could have gone somewhere to resolve this was if there'd been then a strong leader with a very clear parliamentary majority. But as we know, May called a general election in which she actually worsened her own political situation. So I think that has exacerbated this whole political problem. But what I could say is that if there was to be another referendum on the whole question, you can imagine the wrangling that would have to be undertaken in the run-up to that referendum about what the question would be, the terms. So that would take 6 months in and of itself, which again, I completely agree with you, we'd have to look at extending Article 50 just to cope with all of that. And then it begins to raise these other questions. So as Tiki has said, there's a May 2019 European parliamentary election. There's a whole other series of appointments that have to happen in 2019 inside the European Union. All of that would be complicated by a kind of further and ongoing Brexit distraction. Mm. So in a way, the Europeans need this over with as well, which then makes me think that why would the EU27 agree to an extension, which is kind of making a mess of the whole political scene.
And if you have a second referendum that goes the other way, well, you know what the Brexiteers will say. They'll say, well, come on, 2 out of 3. You know, I mean, where's it going to stop?
Well,
you know, you've had a referendum, you don't like the result, well, let's have another referendum. Well, that's really going to work. I mean, I just can't see politically how this will settle things in within Britain. You know?
Do you agree there should have been a referendum in the first place?
Look, I think there should have been a referendum on something as important as this. This referendum was promised and then denied and promised and then denied to the British people, going back to Richard Blair? I don't know. Anyway, certainly Cameron promised and denied or postponed it for on several occasions. And I think the British, it was just really, it was a series of unfortunate events. It was really unfortunate that it was so close. Really unfortunate that May felt she needed to take it to an election. Really unfortunate that the Europeans decided to put somebody who hated Britain as the chief negotiator. You know, we're now in a place where, honestly, if the result is where Britain is worse off in terms of the say it's got in the future of Europe, but having to agree to the rules that it was trying to get out of, well, I mean, what a disaster.
Croc? Yeah. We have a couple more questions. Richard McGregor.
Tiki, on the issue of really unfortunate, is it also really unfortunate that the Brexiteers didn't really tell the population what this entailed? I don't remember the Irish question being debated at all. It was all about savings from the NHS and the like. And isn't one of the root causes of the bitterness now is that nobody, as Anne-Marie said, people are being educated about the EU, that people didn't really understand the difficulty of actually doing this?
Yeah. Look, it's a good question, and we can all go back to the NHS lies, which is, and I totally accept that, I think there was a lot of mischief on both sides. I think the Irish question, again, is naughty, because most people who look at the Irish question from within Britain do not see it as the big, whether you're a Remainer or a Brexiteer, do not see it as the problem that it's blown up into. And once again, this is very clever of Brussels to have seen the Achilles heel that Britain's had and to have blown it. What is the trade over the border now? 0.2% of British GDP. It's nothing. It's nothing. So this has grown up into a big thing, and I don't think it was required, or do I think it was advisable or justifiable for Brexiteers to say, oh, by the way, we're going to have this massive problem with Northern Ireland, because I think that was just the way that the game has been played very cleverly. In terms of Brexiteers are often told, oh, well, you know, you said it was all going to be easy. Perhaps with a stronger leader, it might have been a lot easier. It's very hard to say with hindsight, isn't it? But certainly, looking back now, it's a lot harder than was anticipated. Yeah.
I noticed from one of the polls on what Britons were most concerned about in their lives today, and politics was right up the top there. Brexit at 80% of Britons saying that was what they were most concerned about. And of course, when you ask that question of anybody in the world, you usually get health, education, something like that. But no, Brexit, that was right at the top. So we have, I think we have about 10 minutes left. So I might take two questions at once, and then we'll deal with that. They're just here, and then over here.
Thank you. Brian Everingham, Institute of International Affairs. I've given up on British politics. It's quite clear that both the Conservatives and the Labor Party have been split on this particular issue now for at least a generation, and I don't see any long-term solution to that, even after a third referendum or another vote. What concerns me more is whether or not the European project, as it's called, can also survive this stress, given the other tensions that are occurring across the entire European region, and whether or not the expansion of the European market or the European Union into those fringe states has caused some of those tensions that are now threatening the very fabric of Europe.
John Connor. One thing that seemed to be absent from most of the discussion I've seen of Brexit is that of Switzerland. And I don't understand why that's true. Switzerland has, arguably, by some margin, the highest standard of living in Europe. It's not part of the EU, but it is part of an effective customs union. It maintains some level of immigration control. I'm not quite sure what that level is. There is a high level of complaint within Switzerland that it, because of it being part of the customs union, it's subject to the rules without any input, and also having to make substantial contributions to the EU budget. But I've seen almost no discussion of what the Swiss deal, which has evolved over the years, in fact represents and how it might apply to the UK.
Okay, so firstly, the question of the project survival, European project survival, and then Switzerland. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Great question, and this is my question about European integration as well at the moment. I think, for a start, that as much as, I mean, the British domestic political situation has become so unruly that that's attracted a lot of attention, and people are now thinking of this as British exceptionalism in relation to, you know, what is really the beginning of a process, perhaps, of disintegration in Europe instead of integration. I think it is a mistake to regard Brexit as a case of British exceptionalism. There are some things about it that are exceptional, but you only have to take a cursory glance at European Union politics across the board to see that this is not the only source of trouble and strife. The EU is facing a whole series of challenges in terms of dealing with migration, still the ramifications of the euro crisis from some years ago, and then extreme political movements of both left and right in a number of member states, any of which can imperil the European project in the coming years and certainly within the space of another electoral cycle or two. So I think it is an absolute error of judgment to regard Brexit as a kind of single instance of insanity. I think there's a lot of scope for disintegration to become the norm rather than not. Now, having said that, people tend to underestimate the level of political will behind the European project. It's there, you know, it's happened for a reason. The reason was to prevent war. It has succeeded in that aim, and there is a tremendous amount of support, political support for the EU in political moderates on the continent, and that will continue. But, you know, watch this space, because the news isn't all good. And even in recent examples such as, you know, the recent French presidential election, you know, the results were initially extremely alarming. And you know, what will they be next time round? Also, what on earth is going to happen in Italy? There are so many areas of potential interest here. But in that sense, I think that the EU needs to do a much better job of explaining its purpose to its citizens via its member states. And I think too, more work should be done around Article 50 and what it actually looks like when a member state takes a legitimate decision that they want to leave, because they may be in an equivalent kind of political mess that we're seeing in the UK at the moment, and that has to be dealt with, hopefully, in a more orderly way.
To your point about overreach, I think it is very interesting, the expansionism that Brussels has pushed for, particularly to the east. Particularly in making representations about new members, then join other bodies, to the extent that that has riled Russia. I mean, there is an argument that that's actually what was the final straw, which began the sort of all the Ukraine stuff. So I think there's definitely an argument that Brussels has overreached. Now that's not quite the same thing as say Emmanuel Macron's plans for a stronger Europe and the right left stuff, but in that context, I think that's an issue.
The Switzerland example is an interesting question.
Yeah. So just on Switzerland, then let me begin on that. I mean, Switzerland is a neutral state, right? And it needs to basically take on a lot of rule take. It takes on the rules. It pays a substantial contribution to the EU. All these sorts of things are alarm bells for the architects of Brexit, who really envisaged Brexit as being a liberation of Britain from affairs on the continent that would allow them to forge free trade agreements in their own right, that would allow Britain to take a more assertive position in foreign policy at large, and to resume its function as a great power that was independent and could play a hedging role. None of those things are the Swiss model. So I think that probably answers. If you want to play a supplicant, a prosperous alpine country on the fringes of Europe, then by all means, but I don't think that's what the Brexiteers had in mind when they voted for Brexit. Now, I mean, the other thing on the European project, I would agree. It's too easy to say, oh well, it's the British. They're always a bit eccentric. They're never really fully sold on the political ideals behind the project. They were sort of more in it for the economics. Fair enough, but you're right. You know, that's too easy to say, oh, well, it's just unique to Britain. On the other hand, I would say that Brexit has really been an educative process, even for European citizens, in the sense that they see just what can go wrong if you do decide to go down the path of wanting to get rid of the European Union. You don't really hear the Greeks talking about getting rid of the euro or falling out of the European Union anymore. And there has been a shoring up of support for candidates like Macron in the election, who were enormously pro-European in a way that no politician in Europe has been for quite some time, because it wasn't an electable issue. Suddenly Macron has been able to prove that actually there is, particularly among a more youthful vote, a new sense of optimism and purpose in the European project. So there is some rejuvenation there, and I think you're right that expansionism probably diluted the cohesion of the bloc, also generated some unintended consequences with Russia, and that now the project is about cohesion and consolidation. And in a way, if you lose a few members, it's not a bad thing, because Germany and France have more power to kind of consolidate things in the way they want, in the direction they want, more political integration as opposed to less. There are troubles. I mean, we can talk about Merkel. She's on her way out. We can talk about Macron, the fact that his polling ratings are lower than Donald Trump, obviously. And a lot of the litmus test will be the parliamentary elections. But I would say, actually, Brexit has been a force unifier for the European Union in a way that we didn't expect it to be.
But Italy, I mean, you could get a sort of wacko. I mean, if they announce something in a weekend, you know, that could really rock the boat. Couldn't they? Because you're describing a sort of Europe as a Hotel California now. No one can really leave.
No, I would say you can leave, but the costs of leaving are so high that it actually makes you think, well, there's a point to being in the European Union after all. So because otherwise there's no generation left almost that remembers the time before the European Union. So you sort of take for granted what is default already the case. Which is this level of integration where you take for granted the fact that you can cross borders without passports and that you can set up businesses and study abroad. But suddenly, Brexit has been something that has called into question these basic realities and public goods that people have taken for granted. And they realize that actually you could lose those if you're not careful. And I think in that sense, there's been more optimism and more reason, more rationale for the European project.
Okay, so we'll put the pink champagne on ice in the Hotel California. We are finished. We are run out of time, unfortunately, because I think we could go on for quite some more. I want to thank our panellists, Tiki Fullerton, Dr. Anne-Marie Elijah, and our own Hervé Lemathieu, for a really interesting conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it made some sense of what is an incredibly complex situation. I'm not sure that I'm any clearer now than I was on what the outcome will be come next March, but... But thank you very much all. Well done. Very well done.